You're listening to The Range, Gardner-Webb University streaming and on-demand radio. My name is Jeff Powell. In the studio with me, Dr. Tom Jones. Anybody that has gone to Gardner-Webb in the last, I don't know, many decades knows Dr. Jones. He is the Associate Dean of the Honors Program and Professor of Biology. Dr. Jones, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Full disclosure, I was one of your students. My wife was one of your students. And
lots of people have been one of my students.
As I said, very well known among current students and alumni of Gardner-Webb University. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite a while. It's been in the news a lot. I'm going to guess it's going to be in the news a lot in the years to come. We are here to talk about climate change. Some interesting things going on. I know that the relative scientific bodies to be that pronounce such things have just called 2016 the hottest year on record.
That is correct.
What does that mean?
It's, we've been keeping climate records globally since the 1800s, right? And every year we can figure out the climatic average, temperature average for the globe. Right. And 2016 was the hottest year on record till that time. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, 2015 had been the hottest year on record. Prior to that, 2014, yeah. Hottest year. There's a trend.
Seems
here.
To be a trend here. Yes. Yes. So it's been, I understand, a very, very long time since there's been a record cold year.
Early 1900s, I think. So.
Yeah, so we keep seeing record highs. You know, some people might want to argue, sometimes you see record highs, sometimes you see a record lows, but that is not the trend. The trend is always seems to be in the it's getting warmer.
Part of that may be the difference that is between climate and weather.
Mm-hmm.
Climate is long-term trends. Weather's what happens today, yesterday. Mm-hmm. Yesterday in Boiling Springs, my porch had 82 degrees.
Exactly.
And it was February the 12th.
Exactly.
You know, people might say, oh, yeah, there's global warming. Well, my wife is in Portland, Maine, where they got 2 feet of snow on February right. the 12th. And those folks, if they said, is there global warming, might say, what?
Sure doesn't look like
sure
it.
Sure doesn't
today.
Look like it to me.
So what yeah. How do they do this? I mean, because we are talking about a global average, not just where it is, what the temperature record might be in Boiling Springs, North Carolina, on the campus of Gardner-Webb University, but these global records.
We have to remember that there are meteorologically sampling stations globally, everywhere in the world. And you can go on your internet and find out what the temperature is mm-hmm. in Nairobi mm-hmm. right today, and you can find out what the temperature average was for the year for Nairobi. And when you gather all of that information together, you can look at that. An even better source of information might look at ocean temperatures, right, is where we can measure the amount of heat, especially mm-hmm. in the upper 2,000 feet mm-hmm. or so of the ocean.
Well, you know, there are critics who say that the science isn't in, it isn't proven. And what would you say to those critics who say it's just that the preponderance of evidence isn't there yet? Would you argue they're wrong?
I would very definitely say they're wrong. People will argue about what the causes are. They may argue about how far this thing is going to go. Right. But it's hard to argue with the thermometers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so when you're looking at those issues, there has been global warming. OK. And with that warming comes change in evaporation, precipitation, hazardous weather, et cetera. All those things come along. And some of those arguments about how far it's going to go. Right, have legitimacy, but mm-hmm. it's hard to argue with the global thermometers.
Yeah, I think one of the issues is that in some places, as the temperature warms globally, in some places, oddly enough, it could be cooler.
That is absolutely correct. You do have isolated spots that's happening,
mm-hmm.
and when you look at the global warming trends, right, the closer we are to the equator, the less those temperature increases are.
Yeah.
the farther we are from the equator. So when we get into the poles and the Arctic regions, that's where we're seeing the extreme temperature increases.
Yeah, I've seen some statistics recently over the last several weeks that indicate that parts of the Arctic are 30 degrees above average for this time of the year.
Yeah, and when you're in our whole definition of tundra regions were that there was an area of permafrost, mm-hmm. right? And in the spring, right, and summer, that top layer of the frost would melt and you would get down to this layer that was permanently frozen, the permafrost. And that's where if you built a house or a building, you drove your pilings or your footings down so that they were in that permafrost so that they don't move, right? And then when the permafrost drops by several feet and your pilings are left in the mush that's mm-hmm. on top, it doesn't do a whole lot for the stability of your building.
Well, I've seen stories of entire villages preparing to move because the permafrost that they built on is melting.
Exactly, and we're actually funding that from government funds to move them because we realize that that is a disaster for them. Mm-hmm. At least locally, that's mm-hmm. a disaster.
Yeah. So if we rule out that there is no climate change, climate clearly is changing, we said that there still may be some debate over causes. What does the preponderance of science say? Are humans to blame?
Yes. The preponderance of science says humans are to blame. If you look at climate trends and compare them to solar activity, orbit of the Earth, volcanic activity, all of those, quote, natural events, then they don't match up to the temperature change. If you look at human-caused things, land use, particulates in the atmosphere, and then the big one are greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm. Such as right?
Carbon dioxide is the one that catches the news.
Mm-hmm. Methane right? sometimes as well.
Methane, chlorofluorocarbons. You have to remember that water is a greenhouse gas, right? So that if you're in southeastern United States, our atmosphere usually has a lot of water in it. We don't have a whole lot of up and downs in temperatures on a daily basis, right, compared to the deserts where there is not much water vapor mm-hmm. there, mm-hmm. and their temperature changes over the course of the day are great, right? In our area, if you get a cloud cover at night, temperature's not going to drop as much. If it's clear at night, not as much moisture in the atmosphere, temperatures are going to plummet. And so we can look at that same thing on a global system as well.
Interesting, because I think some of what we see is a warmer Earth means more evaporation, means more water vapor in the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas.
That is correct. Okay.
It also means sometimes, I think sometimes we think of global warming, we think of increased droughts, which is a part of it, but also in other areas, increased rainfall.
That is absolutely correct. So it's when we look at total evaporation, the winds are going to move that moisture around in different places. And in some places, it's going to rain a whole lot more. And in some places, it's going to rain a whole lot less. And you get extremes. You're going to get extremes of precipitation, right? Extremes of drought. Mm-hmm. We're currently hearing about huge amounts of rainfall in Northern California.
Yes.
These were the areas that had severe drought. That fluctuation is not to be unexpected, mm-hmm. right, when it's there. Australia's got some extreme droughts right now. Much of Africa has extreme droughts.
Well, and that brings me to another point. Some people might say, okay, the average temperature is up 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit over what it was a while back. Hey, what's better summers? Is there a problem with this?
Well, if you happen to live in the wheat belts of Canada, right, and it's a little bit warmer and you have a longer growing season, you're saying, let's go with this,
yeah.
right? But if you live in other areas, there are some long-term issues. You have to remember that about 5 degrees centigrade cooler than it was now. Put us in the midst of the Pleistocene glaciations, where the glaciers extended as far down as Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
So those 5 degrees cooler puts us back at an ice age.
Right.
So 5 degrees warmer is going to be something radical as well.
Not pleasant.
Not pleasant, yes. You know, I think the agreement, you know, the world's governing bodies have recognized this. They've come together. They've had meetings after meetings. I think they're now annually meeting in some place or another around the globe to discuss this. And I think they've pretty much agreed that to keep the planet's temperature healthy, we cannot go up more than 2 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And we've already almost gotten there, if I understand correctly. So that when they said 2 degrees
pre-industrial, well above 1.5.
So. We're above 1.5 now, so we're getting close. And what are they saying is going to happen if we go over the 2 degrees?
All of those things that we talked about, moisture, lack of moisture. If we think about just the insect populations, insects are very often limited by moisture and or temperature. As tropical-like temperatures grow beyond what the normal tropical boundaries are. Any of those things that we typically called tropical diseases are going to become extratropical mm-hmm. diseases. Mm-hmm. And those have a potential impact to affect millions of people.
Not saying it's necessarily directly related, but I just remembered the spread of the Zika virus recently. Mm-hmm. It could be an example of something that we'll see more of going forward. So species have to adapt. Animals have to adapt. Insects and larger animals, plant species have to adapt to the changing climates. My understanding is that the climate change is at a rate that far exceeds the ability of sort of natural evolution to take care of these changes.
That's correct. And even for natural migration, you know, if you look at the temperatures warming, if you're a small mammal, right, as temperature was warm, it's easy for you to migrate with that. If you're an oak tree, you know, only in the cartoons did the oak trees pull up their roots, right, and move forward.
That's a good point.
And the normal, I'm not even sure what the normal spread of an oak tree is, but it's in meters per year, mm-hmm. right, that could occur, not kilometers
right,
per
right.
year.
So is it possible that as we see plants and animals trying to adapt to changing climate, that's going to disrupt things for us? It's going to disrupt things as far as food supply and things of this nature?
You know, I think we're already seeing, as climate changes, we're having to shift the things that we grow. Now, we are, you know, humans are primarily calorie-wise. We get most of our calories from grains, rice and corn, and wheat, sorghum, okay? And those, the ranges where those grow may change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wheat belt in Canada is getting farther north. Well, that means the wheat belt in the United States is disappearing at its southern end. And we're depending more and more, you know, the original wheat belt, they weren't irrigated. Right, we're irrigating mm-hmm. those now, and that water also has to come from someplace.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes from what's I think sometimes called fossil water, underground aquifers.
Yeah, stuff in the aquifers, and you know they're saying that most of the water that we are mining, I think the aquifer that's probably the most studied is the Ogallala Aquifer, right? That the water that's been there has been there for 10,000 years or more. And so it doesn't recharge immediately, even though you may get lots of snow and rain up in the mountains.
I know there's a tendency to think of water being sort of something that recycles, but if you're talking about mining water that takes thousands of years to accumulate and you're using it, then it's not a renewable resource.
Yeah, if I'm pulling money out of my checking account at $1,000 a month while my checking account is only having additions of $10 a month. It doesn't take you long to realize that there is a deficit.
There's a deficit. You know, this all reminds me of the fact that many scientists are now saying that we are living through the sixth great extinction of mm-hmm. plant animal species on this planet. Now, this is all related in some way, isn't it?
Yeah. It's, you know, when we think about all the extinctions, right, they were all long-term. Right, you know, even if we talk about the dinosaur extinction, right, that was over thousands of years, right, and if we look at the extinction rate now, probably the thing that we see most is if we look at amphibians, because they spend part of their life in an air environment and part of their life in an aquatic environment, and therefore they are susceptible to any changes in any of those. And the folks who study amphibians in the tropics are worried because we're looking at many of the species that were there even just two decades ago can no longer be found.
Mm, disappearing species. And a lot of this has to do, as we've said, with human industrialization, expansion, lack of habitat, that sort of thing. So I guess the next question is, what can we do about it?
It would be nice to say that there's a quick answer, okay? It would be nice to say that there is an answer that's easy to do, that won't cost us anything. But I think we're still up in the air about how much this is going to cost, how long it's going to take, how much energy it's going to take, and it's going to take a lot, right? It's one of those things you don't have. We have all this momentum going into this, and it's not going to come to an immediate stop, right, and reverse itself unless we have political will, right, to do this. And this has to be across the board, not just one nation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we are willing to put some money where our mouth is, right, and do that, and realize that things may change, right? You know, if you had talked to somebody about hybrid cars in the 1950s, they would say, you've been reading too many of those science magazines. They're never going to happen, right? Or solar power. You've been reading too many of those science magazines. That's never going to happen. We're seeing those happen, right? And they do have an impact. And even our fossil fuel plants are becoming much more efficient at extracting and using the heat that comes from those, so that it takes fewer tons of coal, right, to produce this amount of electricity, fewer gallons of oil to produce this electricity. Because the power companies say, you know, if I can produce this stuff, use the same amount of energy, but produce more, right, that's good for the bottom line.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's a long-term thing. You know,
but many critics will say that trying to fix this, to get fossil fuels out of the economy, et cetera, would simply ruin the economy.
I don't think it would ruin it. It would change it, right? We are still going to be, we're energy driven. We are an energy hog economy. Everything that we do requires energy. And my favorite person, Joe Public, right? Joe Public doesn't really care where his energy comes from, mm-hmm. as long as it's affordable for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in Cleveland County, we've seen a phenomenal increase in the number of solar arrays and solar farms. Coastal North Carolina, we're seeing some wind energy stations. And as the price of these comes down, right, it's going to be to the point that they're pretty affordable, right? You know, solar shingles on houses, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Not having to have special solar panels, et cetera, but just being able, when you re-roof your house, putting solar shingles on there. You know, when it gets to the point that those solar shingles are only 2 to 3 times the price of regular shingles. But by the way, you don't have to pay for electricity anymore. Mm-hmm. And where we are, if you produce excess electricity, right, you can put that into the grid, and the power companies will pay you for that, mm-hmm. right? And so that will change some things in there. Is it going to be a wonderful thing for the folks who mine coal or drill for oil? No, it's not. Is it going to be a wonderful thing for the folks who produce windmills, right, and electric power panels, et cetera? It will be. So that's going to change. You know, not many of us hand sew stuff anymore, mm-hmm. right? That
changed.
It changed, yeah. Right? We don't have, you know, you can't go around the corner and find the local stable that's going to reshoe your horse for you while you're in town shopping, mm-hmm. right? That is long gone. Right. It changed. And I'm sure that the folks who were doing that job in the 1800s were complaining about all these other things coming in that were going to take their jobs. Mm-hmm.
So it's quite the challenge. It's going to take a lot of political and social will mm-hmm. to make this transaction to a non-fossil fuel energy economy.
It is. And, you know, it's going to take a long time. This is not going to occur overnight. And systems adapt. They all do. Sometimes we adapt kicking and screaming and being drugged, but we do adapt.
Right. All right. Well, that's a good hopeful note. I think that'd be a good place to end it on an up note.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Dr. Tom Jones, professor at Gardner-Webb University, biology, and also the dean of the honors program here at the university. And again, if you've come across Gardner-Webb campus anytime in the last number of decades, we'll leave the number a little vague. You probably ran across Dr. Jones at some point. If you'd like to comment, reach out, give some questions answered, anything like that. Just email us here at the station, info@wgwg.org. We'll be sure to pass them on to Dr. Jones. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.